On today's podcast, I speak with Dr. Chris Raleigh-Baker. Dr. Chris is Australia's first Aboriginal ophthalmologist and the current president of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. We discuss his work with the Fred Hullows Foundation, the impact of eye conditions on cultural and spiritual practices in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and we give some top tips for emergency eye care and GP. We did experience some signal loss as a big storm had come through Brisbane, where this is being recorded, so we do apologise for any dropout in the conversation.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
So hello there, my name's Dr. Danielle Arabina, and I'm being joined today on the podcast by Dr. Chris Raleigh-Baker. He is our first Australian Indigenous ophthalmologist, and he is the current president of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. So he was the vice president when Carly, who was our previous guest, was our president. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks very much for having me on your show today.
Excellent. Now, Chris, we've got so many exciting things to talk about. Eyes is something that I personally freak out with in GP land. So I'd love to get some tips at the end around that. But first of all, I'd love to know a bit about you. Who's your mob and where are you working now?
Yeah, sure. So my mob is Yuggera, so Brisbane. So I grew up on country in Brisbane, but also Warrangal, Birragubra and Juru up from North Queensland. That's all on my mum's side. My dad's side is Radjuri from the Riverina area. And I arrived back in Brisbane, maybe 3 weeks ago now, and I've been travelling around since May last year doing my fellowship. So just hit home turf and letting the dust settle at the moment.
Fantastic. It's always a nice place to be home, I think, when you travel a lot. So where have you been working? It sounds like you've been doing some amazing and interesting work.
I've been all over. So last year for 7 months I was doing the Fred Hullows Foundation Ophthalmology Fellowship and things for 4 months and Fiji for 3 months. I was based in Suva at the Pacific Eye Institute, which was absolutely brilliant experience, the whole Fred Hullows Fellowship. And at the beginning of this year I was in Western Australia with an ophthalmologist over there called Angus Turner. It was a lot of work from the very top to the very bottom of Western Australia and all the way in between. And I basically saw the whole state in about 5 or 6 months.
Wow.
And a few other little inches between. That brings us up to where I am now. So it's been an incredible experience.
Excellent. So, Chris, you just dropped out a little bit there, but I heard that you were working all over the state basically in Western Australia, which would be amazing, I think, particularly working in those rural and remote communities. How did you find Indigenous eye health in those areas?
The thing with West Australia is it's such a big state, it varies where you are. So down south where it's obviously a lot more affluent, the Margaret River and Albany, Esperance, very, very pretty areas, the Indigenous ophthalmology wasn't as dire as up north. Ananara, Broome, the Pilbara, and the Kimberleys. Mm-hmm. So it was variable all the way across, like a lot of our communities. There's a lot of variation. But overall, I don't like to talk about it, you know, a deficit-based approach
sure.
to health, but
yeah.
Overall, there's a lot of work that does need to be done in ophthalmology over there. And as I said, Angus Turner runs an incredible program over there and does an absolutely awesome job. And they've had a lot of gains over the last, you know, number of years to get to where they are, but there's still, yeah, like everything, there's still a way to go.
Sure. And I know that the Fred Hullows Foundation does a lot of work around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander eye health. What did you work specifically? I know you're in Fiji, were you? Is that correct for the Fred Hullows, not in Australia?
I was in both. So I was in Alice Springs working with another amazing ophthalmologist out there. He's actually the only one in Central Australia. Tim Henderson's his name. And I was with him months, so two-month stints with Fiji in between, again with the Fred Hullows Foundation. Fred Hullows do a lot, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, to support Indigenous eye health in Australia and overseas. And I had the privilege to work with them in their Indigenous Australia Eye Health Program in Central Australia, and then across at the Pacific Eye Institute in Suva. And the Pacific Eye Institute trains ophthalmology for the Pacific region. So I was working with people from Tonga, from Solomon Islands, East Timor, Fiji itself, all across the Pacific, and they go there to train in ophthalmology.
Were there any eye conditions that were different between, the say, the two nations or groups of people, like between Fiji and some that were similar and some not? I imagine things like diabetes, eye disease was sort of common.
So a lot of what we saw in Fiji itself, for the Fijians and the Atuki, the native Fijians, the trainees come from right across the Pacific, so I didn't see many people from outside of Fiji. And the idea is that the trainees come to the Pacific Eye Institute, train at the PEI, and then return home. Certainly in the Fijian populations, similarly to here in Australia, there's a lot of diabetes, but the presentations across the board were a lot more advanced. And I remember there was one example, was an enormous BCC on a lady's forehead, and it was the size of a 50-cent piece.
Mm.
It's very unusual that we'd see something like that, obviously, in Australia. So the pathology was similar, but a lot more advanced, a lot further down the track. And it's a very resource-limited environment, and it was incredible watching the doctors over there work and do so much with such limited resource capacity.
Mm.
So the lady with, well, one particular I remember had this huge 50-cent piece ulcerative BCC on her upper eyelid, and we removed it in theatre with literally the diathermy was using a flame, and you heat up a little hot rod and with this light flame in theatre and use the hot rod to abate the bleeding. We didn't have any frozen section control. It was all guesswork, and that went off to the pathologist. By the time that had returned, we didn't have the capacity to do skin grafts or anything, so it was laissez-faire. It just had to heal of its own core. It healed really, really well. But it was months and months after she had actually healed that the results came through. So that's your environment that you're working in over there, which is an incredibly enriching experience. But in terms of diagnosis, long way down the track, perceptional light cataracts, that type of thing, bilateral PEOL cataracts.
Yep. Yeah. Amazing. So in Australia, what do you think are the biggest sort of impacts on, we know that, say, hearing deficits have a big impact on particularly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and their sort of long-term education. What do you see around eye health and the impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
The first two big diagnoses in our mob are diabetes, of course, impacting the eyes, and cataracts. And our cataracts tend to be a lot more advanced than the general population. There are a series of reasons for that. The impact that poor vision has in communities can be far more than the individual not being able to see and move around the house. And I was approached by one of the health workers when I was in Kununurra, actually. And he came and he said, "Oh, doc, I just want to say, thanks for what you're doing out here." And, it was a lovely gesture, and I sort of thanked him. And he said, no, I don't think you actually realise the impact you have. I said, "Oh, well, what do you mean?" He said, "Look, what you're doing is by giving these people, they're not able to get around the house and do their washing and do their day-to-day duties." He said, "Yeah, it's all of that, but it's also more than that." He said, "By giving them their sight back, they're able to go out bush and get their bush tucker. That then gives them exercise. That improves blood glucose level.
Mm.
It also allows them to interact more with the community and go out in groups. And the most important thing is they can go out and they can find the important places and perform ceremony and hand out culture." And that was the moment where I realized the enormity of what we're actually doing out there for vision, for what is a reasonably routine procedure nowadays, a complicated procedure, cataract surgery, it's microsurgery, but reasonably routine. We do a lot of it all day, every day. But the impact was far, far, far wider than even I had envisaged. And in fact, by doing cataract surgery and by improving the diabetes of these individuals, it's improving not only the individual's life, but the whole community's life, because it's building the capacity to engage in culture.
Yeah, that's so, so important, because we try to talk to my listeners and I talk to my registrars around seeing that holistic viewpoint of health. So, you know, when you're treating a knee, you're actually not just treating a knee, you're treating, you know, their capacity to engage in cultural activities. And so that's such important work, you know, because we take sight for granted, really, I think, because it's just a given, and, you know, over age we get the old, you know, aging sort of eyes. But to be able to still share and pass on that knowledge to the younger kids coming through is so important. So what amazing work you're doing, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, it is. That's so important. So what do you think is, you know, one of the things we talk to registrars a lot about is the delayed presentations, or, you know, people coming in when things, you know, they've got a 50 centimetre, say, BCC on their face, as you said before. What, you know, what do you think some of the reasons are around that?
Okay. So there can be fear, purely and simply fear, and people are fearful of engaging the system, either because they're scared of the diagnosis or because of historical reasons, as we know, stolen generation and a whole litany of insults against our peoples. So there's fear of the system. There's also fear of the cultural capacity of the system, and that ties into cultural safety issues, which is working on a project at the moment. But to go into an institution and not feel welcomed or understood is a reason why people will then not go in. The other reason is, depending on where you are, some of our peoples have the belief that you go to hospital to die.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And communities, because a lot of the time when they're sent from the local health centre into the big metropolitan area, it's because those individuals are very, very sick and therefore statistically less likely to survive. But the community then has the perspective that, oh, no, you go to the big hospital to die. And also in our mob, I've noticed, particularly in the rural remote communities, there's and my grandmother was the same, actually. I remember it distinctly. There was a real reluctance to engage in surgery. And my nanny used to say, no, they're not taking anything away from me. They're not taking anything from my body. And I remember that as a very, very young child. And so she literally never had an operation. And the same theme is up over and over and over again across Central Australia, across Queensland, across the top end of the Northern Territory, right across Western Australia. There's a real reluctance to have surgery, to have a part of your body removed.
Yes.
And so for all those reasons, there can be a reluctance to engage in the health system.
Yeah, and I agree. Like, I've heard patients, you know, they're worried about when their body is being cut, it's actually a weakness then in their body. So, you know, if someone was performing, you know, black magic or sorcery against them, it's an easy access point. If we're talking about that in a spiritual term as well. You know, maintaining the integrity of the body is actually really important. So that's a really good point that you've come up with. So
yeah,
and I don't think it's important, I think, for our doctors to know that what's the reason behind the delayed appointment, because we often go, well, God, wouldn't you just turn up if you've got, you know, your eyes, you know, red or sore, or you can't see out of the eye? But sometimes it is this deep-seated fear that you just really can't get past, because a lot of our people, our mob, go to hospital to die.
Yeah, that's, you know, right.
So I used to work at Redcliffe Hospital, and it was actually known in the community as Deadcliffe. So there was a big reluctance to go there because you'd go there to die. So we actually did a smoking ceremony in the hospital and made it more Indigenous friendly, put lots of artwork around and flew the flags to sort of help repair that sort of ideology in the community, or, you know, make it easier access.
And so just touching on what you just said around the artwork and the paintings, a lot of non-Indigenous people will criticise the symbolism or tokenistic, but actually they can make a big difference, and it's, again, about building the cultural capacity in the institution. The other thing I noticed at the top end was of the Northern Territory, that if there was a diagnosis, there was a sense of que sera sera, what will be, and that this is that whatever is developing in their body is a part of a bigger picture, or, you know, a grand design and with. So we would go up there, and cataracts were the classic example. If they had cataracts, they would often be really quite severe and impacting on the individual until they would engage in surgery. What I noticed working across the top end, and this is an area-specific issue, but there was an overlay of cultural reasons also not to come in and engage. And that was that there was a sense within the Yolngu up in the top of que sera sera, or you know, what will be. And that was that if there was a developing diagnosis in their body, that was connected to the spiritual realm and that to fate almost. And it's meant to be happening, it's meant to be there. And so Western intervention was seen as running counter to the cultural obligations of the body and the obligations to the spirit, because it was intervening in something that should otherwise be the way it is.
Mm.
And even for cataract surgery, that will come up as an issue. People would have very, very poor vision, but it would be right up until the last minute, almost when they couldn't see anything, when they'd finally agree to cataract surgery, because there's a sense of, no, this is what my body is meant to be doing. This is a part of a greater cycle.
Yeah.
And as I said, it was top end, you know, really quite traditional people, as well as all the other issues we talked about. But there can be localized issues like that too. That even for that particular area, I wasn't aware of that as being a driver for those people. You know, obviously not being country for me and not being mobs. Just the diversity of experience out there of our mob.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a fascinating insight too, is that, you know, just that this is what's meant to happen to me and, you know, I'll accept it. So, and being, it must be sort of difficult or challenging, I suppose, to come in and say, well, actually there's a way I can actually fix this and make it a bit better for you. So that would be quite challenging to sort of change their belief system around, actually, I don't need to, this isn't my lot in life, you know, so.
Yeah, and there's an ethical issue in that as well, you know.
Mm.
If that is the belief system, is it right for us as Western-trained doctors to go in and then say, well, no, it isn't correct. We need to remove that cancer, or we need to do your cataracts, or and there's a whole area there that I don't think has really been discussed in the Indigenous health space at this point.
Mm.
What right does culture have to determine what an individual does in their body, and how far should so-called education in the Western sense go towards addressing that? Because then what becomes cultural imperialism? And it's a really thin line. And also the whole human aspect of that. You know, it's incredibly complex.
But
I think it's an area that does require a lot more thought in academia.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, as doctors we want to do no harm and we come in to serve people and help people. But that's a really interesting point, like in the point, like when we come up against culture, which is more important.
Mm.
So, yeah.
We have to be aware of that as Western-trained black doctors as well, that because we're taught a certain way of thinking, and obviously we're taught in the Western paradigm, but we then have to be aware not to impose those Western ideals on our own mob.
Yes.
And therefore compound the issues of colonization. So
it's the paternalism.
Road to travel.
It's a paternalism, isn't it? Because we know what's right for you. So you just do what we tell you to do because it's right for you. So, I think that's really something that all of our doctors who listen to this need to sit with and contemplate and be open to listening to the other side as well, to go, well, okay, if this is their belief system, what an interesting space to sit in, I think, and a realisation.
Where do we draw that line?
Yeah, Chris.
And how do we not become a part of the oppressor's tool?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Chris, fascinating and discussion so far, but I'd love to change it up a little bit to move to a bit more sort of eye health and GP, because as I mentioned at the top of this interview, it's something that always freaks me out. If people come to me with eyes, I'm like, why are you here? Just go straight to the hospital. So what is this, first of all, the start of, in GP land, we see a lot of diabetic eyes. So for our Indigenous population, our Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander population, what's the impact there? And what can we do as doctors to make it better?
Okay. So the first thing to say about diabetic-related eye disease, and we don't have an explanation for this, is that there can be individuals who have really very poorly controlled diabetes for a long, long time and develop minimal disease, or there will be diabetic patients who will have a recent diagnosis of diabetes and they will for a period of time, sort of early diabetes, but they will just develop florid disease. We don't know why that is. There must be some sort of biochemical mechanism or receptor or something that we haven't worked out yet.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing to say is that it's really, really, really important, but it's not everything. The other big part of the puzzle is having patients be seen, because even patients, as I said, with good control, some of them will still go on to develop florid diabetic eye disease. If you don't look, you don't find. And so to do that, there are a number of systems available. There are screening systems available through Aboriginal Medical Services in Queensland. There's a van that goes around called the Ideas Van. A number of optometrists on where they are and their training can do some screening. And then, of course, if there's any further concern, there's the ophthalmologist to see them, as well as the public system that people can be referred to. So there are a number of places where GPs can refer their ophthalmic or their diabetic patients for an ophthalmic review. In terms of the diabetes itself, it's divided into two types. So you might see in your letters, you'll see it described as non-proliferative or proliferative. Proliferative, generally we watch. Proliferative, generally we treat, and we'll treat with laser. So that's the retinopathy, which is the peripheral stuff. And there's a central disease, and we call that maculopathy. And the maculopathy, the one that we treat with injections. Some of you listeners might have had letters back from the ophthalmologist or heard of patients going for injections in their eyes for their diabetes. Well, that'll be for the maculopathy. The maculopathy will degrade your vision really quite quickly because it's your central vision, it's your macula. Whereas the peripheral disease, the retinopathy, that's the proliferative or non-proliferative one, that in the long term will make your vision much, much worse because it'll cause retinal detachments and bleeds. But in the short term, you won't necessarily notice it. You can have terrible proliferative retinopathy and not know about it until you have a bleed. And that's really why we need to be screening people and watching closely. Specifically for our mob, long diabetes, we tend to get it earlier and it tends to be more severe. The other part of the diabetes story in our population is that we already have earlier cataracts and the diabetes will push the cataracts along faster. So for a number of reasons, our vision will tend to go off at a more rapid rate than a non-Indigenous patient's.
Mm-hmm.
And the key to that is screening. The key to that is looking.
So how often do you think that we should we be screening if they're not diabetic but Indigenous, like during maybe a week?
If they're not.
Yep.
But when a patient has a new diagnosis of diabetes, they should be screened. And that's because they might have had diabetes for quite a while and
yes.
There may already be some pre-existing disease there that we don't know about. The medicine is we often miss things not because we don't know but because we don't look.
Yes.
And so the take-home message for listeners is once you've diagnosed someone with diabetes, get them along to an optometrist or a screening van or wire. Just to have a look. And what should happen in the ideal system is they should write you a letter back saying, this is what they have, ABC, and this is the plan. You know, review in 6 months or 12 months or 24 months or 5 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And then that will feedback, we're able to tie that into your system.
We do have that in our diabetes annual screen. So we check urine, we check blood pressure, we check eyes. But I think specifically we should be looking at doing our 715s, our Indigenous health checks, and that's covered in there as well. So we can actually do that screening every 9 months. You can claim that through Medicare. So I think that that's really important for our doctors to know that as well. So I didn't know that it accelerates cataracts as well, having a diagnosis of diabetes. So that's fascinating and scary.
Mm.
Speaking of scary, Chris, red eyes and GP. What have you got to tell me? That scares the crap out of me, that one.
All right. Okay, look, first thing to say is luckily most red eyes that enter GP land are conjunctivitis related and they're probably a conjunctivitis, but that's not to say to relax with it. Next thing to say is with a unilateral red eye, people get very, very worried about angle closure. Angle closure isn't overly common and generally something closure, the eye will tend to be really quite painful and the cornea will be steamy. So you should be able to pick that up. And if there is any concern about that, either get them along to the emergency department or get them to an optometrist, at least for someone to have a look. I would like for GPs to be more comfortable using a slit lamp or dealing with ophthalmic diagnosis, but obviously that's something that has to happen in the long term. The red flag, though, with the red eye is in relation to contact lens wear. This is a really easy one to miss, and it's not taught because we're so poorly taught ophthalmology in most medical schools. And it's a very easy one to pick up, but also very easy to miss it. And any red eye that comes through the door, the question should be asked is, do you wear contact lenses? And if the answer is yes, then I would be seeking further opinion. I'd either be calling up my local friendly ophthalmologist or I'd be sending him along to an emergency department and assess this patient with a red eye related to contact lens use. Now, the reason why that's important is because contact lenses can be associated with a very aggressive type of keratitis, so an infection in the cornea. And the one that I worry about as ophthalmologists is Pseudomonas keratitis. And Pseudomonas is everywhere and it loves living on contact lenses. And particularly the contact lenses that particularly cause problems are the extended wear or extended use contact lenses. So the questions you want to ask is firstly, do you wear contact lenses? If the answer is yes, you say, are they disposable contact lenses? So that increases the risk profile. The next question you need to say, are they extended wear? Because that extends your risk profile again, you know, the 2-week or 4-week ones, because they sit in those nice little warm petri dishes where Pseudomonas loves. And the next question you need to ask is, and how old were they? And the vast majority of the time, contact lens keratitis, they'll be extended wear, they'll be 2 or 4 weeks, and they'll have had them for longer than what they should be. Those people you've got to get in to see an ophthalmologist
straight away
that day, you know, because Pseudomonas can cause a penetrating injury. It can burrow right through your cornea within 24 hours, and that's the one that we worry about as ophthalmologists. So if you ask one thing and one thing alone with a red eye, it's do you wear contact lenses?
Fantastic. That's a great takeaway tip. But I just need to clarify, what penetrates in the eye, the contact lens? Does it burrow in?
No.
Oh, I was going to say that would freak me out so much. I'd be like, oh.
Yeah, no. Usually by the time you see them because it's driving them nuts.
Yeah.
And what you'll see, clinically what you'll see, if people are interested, is the cornea should be clear, you know, like a front windscreen of a car. And just like a stone chip in the front windscreen, you'll get a little white spot there. And that's an active, if there is an infection, that'll be the active infection. And, yeah, so those little bugs, they'll eat away at the collagen fibres and they will weaken the collagen fibres. And if they get all the way to the end of the layer, you know, of the cornea on the inside of the eye, then it can actually perforate and you can end up with, you know, aqueous running down the cheek. It's not good. It's very bad.
Oh, gross.
Gross
but fascinating. Yeah. Wow. Okay, so that is a fantastic tip for our doctors. So I'm just going to run.
That's the one you got to pick up.
I'm just going to run through that again because you were dropping in and out a little bit, but hopefully we've got most of it. So the big important things are, if someone presents with a red eye, do you wear contact lenses? If yes, are they disposable? If yes, are they extended wear? Have you been wearing them for 2 to 4 weeks? So you ask sort of how long they've been wearing them. Is that a good summary, Chris?
Yep, that's it. And it's kind of like doing an alcohol history. You know, you don't say, oh, do you have one beer a night? You say, oh, what, do you have a carton? Do you have two cartons?
Yeah.
So push the boundaries of what's considered normal. And if they're 2 to 4 weeks, say, well, you're wearing them for what, 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks? And then often they'll fess up to how long they're actually wearing them.
Fantastic. So is there any other eye tips that you've got for us in GP land apart from the because I think there's so much work that GPs, you know, obviously this eye stuff is a big deficit for us, or we need to know more. So is there anything else, any other little tips you could give our listeners that you can think of?
Yeah, there is. Look, there's two, actually. There's two. And, again, they're red flags. First one is if a patient above the age of 50 comes in with intermittent double vision or sudden loss of vision, do an ESR, CRP, and full blood count. think of giant cell arteritis. People say it's rare. It is out there, and a lot of the time it was met with either double vision or intermittent vision loss. So just keep that in your head, that GCA is out there, and then obviously get them up to the emergency department. The second thing is don't miss the penetrating injury. So ask if someone comes in and says, I was hammering steel on steel, or I was grinding and I got a bit of a funny feeling in my eye now. Don't just assume it's a foreign body. Ask exactly what they were doing. Were they wearing safety goggles? And when was the onset of their symptoms? Have a look in the eye, because some of them can be quite subtle. So take home, don't miss a giant cell arteritis. That one's, you know, if you think of it, again, if you think of it, then you won't miss it. And don't miss the penetrating eye injury. And ask those, what were you doing? What was the mechanism? Did you have goggles on?
Yeah. So, Chris, what I'm going to do is put some show notes up. So if we can maybe try and get a link so that people can, maybe a fact sheet or something that we can have, like put them in the show notes so listeners can go and have a look, just so that they can help remember those things, or it might help with people's study or something like that. Fantastic. Because you freaked, we had a conversation before and you freaked me out a bit saying that GPs are being sued around eye stuff. What were you saying around that?
Yeah, so in terms of medico-legal issues, one of the areas that GPs are most litigated for are eye-related conditions, and yet it's the area that GPs feel least comfortable with. Mm. Ophthalmic-related diagnosis. So it really is an area that as two craft groups, we've got to work together more and address. You know, I'd love for the GP community to have a greater capacity to actually sit down and have a conversation with patients comfortably about their eye presentation as easily as you would with a heart presentation or a lung presentation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so important.
I think we really need to build that capacity.
Yeah. So, Chris, where for you now? So I understand you're doing some locum work, and you might be working with one of my favourite people, Associate Professor Noel Heyman out at the Inala Indigenous Health Clinic. What are you doing out there?
Oh, yes. So I have the great privilege of having had Noel approach me and ask me if I could get involved at the Inala Centre of Excellence, and I'll certainly be taking him up on his offer. To start with, it'll be once a month, and I'll be working alongside another wonderful ophthalmologist called Dr. Rowan Porter, who's been working at Inala with Noel for quite a while, and working out there once a month. There's a cataract pathway out there as well that Rowan is very, very keen to get me involved with, so I'll be engaging with Inala, which is really, really exciting. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a public post, and there's a process happening around that at the moment. So hopefully I'll be able to work in the public system part-time, but mm-hmm. Remain engaged with registrars. I'm looking at private rooms as well. And the bottom line is for my day-to-day work, I'll be working between Sunshine Coast, so Caloundra would be my ideal, and in Brisbane. And then continue my outreach work. So next year I'm scheduled in for 3-week trips, outreach trips to Alice Springs. And I've been asked if I can head over to Derby in Western Australia for a week as well, which is really important to keep that perspective, because rural remote medicine is such a rewarding area of medicine. And really for me, my idea of hell would be, you know, to work in private rooms 5 days a week on Wickham Terrace for the next 50 years. I think that would just drive me crazy, because it's just such incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible.
Patients are so wonderful. You know, they'll wait. Yeah, it's so rewarding. They'll wait 3 hours for a 20-minute appointment. You know, they'll drive 3 hours to see you and then 3 hours back home. And they're just wonderful, wonderful people. Really appreciate what you do out there. So for any of your listeners, you know, if they want to do some rural remote work, I would encourage them in whatever area they're in.
Yeah, I think that is so important. So thank you, Chris. So Chris, just to confirm, we're going to put your some contact details for yourself onto our show notes. So the vision for you will be not only being the AIDA president, and I know that that's going to be quite busy for you, but you'll be looking at setting up your own private practice. So any of our listeners could drop you a line and say, can you see this patient? Because it sounds like you're all over it.
Yeah. Certainly when my rooms are set up and available, then I'd be more than happy to see patients.
Let us know and we'll share it with our audience, because I think that the work you're doing is very valuable in the community. So, Chris, just thank you so much for the time that you were able to share with us today. I've learned so much from that, particularly around the, you know, that understanding that we talked about, that ethical dilemma, I suppose, around what I know to be cultural and spiritual strength mightn't really So what I understand, our conversation we had before, Chris, around the cultural and spiritual strengths and how Western-trained doctors need to understand that those strengths mightn't really gel well with what we understand is the best way to treat people. So that was a really important conversation. So thank you for that. Plus, I feel a little less scared around eyes, or I know I'm going to ask people about contact lenses, number one.
Yep.
So any final words for our audience, Chris?
Thanks very much for having me on your show. I would like to do more teaching where possible. And I know last year there was a teaching session over in Bali that happened for ophthalmology that I did. There will be one coming up in Fiji next year. So if people keep their eyes out for that, so to speak, excuse the pun, then that will be happening. And look, as I said, I'm wanting to remain engaged in this space and really build the capacity of it within GP land help wherever I can. Privilege. And a little plug for Ada as well. We had our first ophthalmology workshop this year that went really well. We'll be running another one next year up in Darwin. So I encourage GPs, new registrars, to belong to Ada 2019 in Darwin and sign up for the ophthalmology workshop.
Yeah, so we might actually put the Ada membership down on the show notes as well. Because I'm also a member and past board member of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. So passionate about that organisation, doing such great work in the community. And it's so amazing that we're being, you know, we're just getting bigger and bigger and going from strength to strength as an organisation. And it's wonderful to offer that ophthalmology workshop. I might even come in now that I'm not so scared of eyes, Chris. All right, Chris. So thank you.
Please do.
So, Chris, thank you so much for your time today, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.